Please silence all electronic devices.
I'm sorry, folks. I don't trust them. And our folks don't trust them.
There is a great deal of overreaction from those who are criticizing this legislation. They will see me in court. You know, if the General Assembly were really trying to do a power grab, there's a lot of things the General Assembly could do, and we weren't.
And they don't have a very good track record there.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the Friday Center in Chapel Hill, this is the WUNC Politics Podcast. It's July 3rd, 2019, an assortment of topics on this edition of the program. Glad to have you along wherever you're listening from on this holiday weekend. Your guest today, WUNC data reporter, back on the pod, Jason DeBruin. Hey, man, how are you?
Hey, doing well. Hope you are.
We're going to start on the healthcare front. There is an ongoing standoff. Some, including you, have called this a game of chicken. It's between the Republican state treasurer, Dale Falwell, and the hospitals across the state. Many of, if not all of the hospitals, as we record this. Republican lawmakers are somewhat fractured. More on that in a moment. We'll also discuss the timing of this thing. But stuck in the middle are more than 700,000 state employees. Remind us, just to kick it off, what is ultimately hanging in the balance for those hundreds of thousands of workers?
Oh, well, potentially some massive hospital bills, because if there's no hospitals that sign on to what Treasurer Falwell wants to do, and as of yet there hasn't been a single one and there doesn't appear to be one on the horizon, then every hospital in North Carolina would be out of network for those state health plan members. So, you know, if you think of your in-network, out-of-network, when something's in-network, your health insurer sort of takes care of everything. You might have a copay, but that's pretty minimal compared to the top-line charge. Well, if you go out-of-network, you, the individual, the patient, are sort of facing that top-line charge. You might try to get reimbursed later, but, you know, right up front, you're facing hospital bills that could be in the tens or in some cases even hundreds of thousands of dollars.
So you say in-network, out-of-network, specifically hospital visits. What about specialists? What about primary care physicians? Is that stuff also on the table or not so much?
Absolutely, yeah, same story. So the reason I single out hospitals is because there hasn't been a single one to sign on yet. There have been some healthcare practices, the most notable being the ECU physician practices that have signed on. So there's a handful of, I say a handful, more than a handful, but a good amount of doctors in the eastern part of the state that have signed on and that would go in network if, you know, if nothing changes. But, you know, the Duke faculty physicians, UNC faculty physicians, you know, the doctors throughout Charlotte, the Triad, those have not signed on either. And yeah, the, you know, same story, I suppose. A doctor office visit, though not cheap, is less than a hospital visit. So, you know, you're looking at a smaller bill, comparatively speaking, but still one that would potentially be significant.
All right. So Falwell issued this, I'll call it a shot across the bow, just to use a cliche here on the July 4th holiday weekend. He said earlier this year he wanted to save some $300 million. And he also is pushing for greater transparency about billing and about why there is inconsistency on why certain things in Asheville, same procedure in Asheville versus Raleigh, could be billed drastically different. Sometimes hospitals across the street from one another or around the corner from one another charge drastically different amounts for very similar, if not identical, services. So Falwell, to his perspective, is trying to generate a little bit more transparency, but the hospitals say that this proposed cut of $300 million is simply something that they cannot stomach. It would lead to hospital closures in some rural and some urban areas, I believe, across the state. Take it from there. What else is this really about between the Hospital Association and Falwell?
Right. If I could maybe just tweak what you're saying, they
sure.
say that they would be closed. You know, we don't know that, right?
Right.
I
mean, that's what they say. No, we do not know that for a fact. That hospitals would close if the reimbursement rates changed and there was this cut of $300 million.
But yeah, but so hopefully not to get too far in the weeds, but any health insurer, so the state health plan, although it's, you know, a government, a quasi-government entity and is made up of government workers, does not act as a government payer, the way we think of, say, Medicare or Medicaid, in terms of how it reimburses hospitals and providers, is almost exactly like a private health insurance plan, the one that any private employee might get through their workplace. And so what that means is that the state health plan works with Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, which is the state health plan's third-party provider, the third-party entity that then does the negotiations on its behalf Blue Cross then goes to every provider and every hospital in the state and negotiates a reimbursement rate for everything, knee replacements, hip replacements, a heart attack, an emergency procedure, anything has a negotiated rate. And that's where you get these sometimes big differences in what some in the reimbursements for some hospitals versus others. And that's because it's negotiated separately. So Blue Cross might negotiate with, say, Duke for a $5,000 for a hip replacement, but it negotiates for a $3,000 hip replacement with UNC. All of that is negotiated ahead of time, and then that's what's paid out. Well, unfortunately, but it's a reality that those reimbursement numbers are trade, quote unquote, trade secrets. And that's what the treasurer wants to get at. He wants to know how much, because even he doesn't know, even the payer, you know, even you and I as members of the state health plan, and even Treasurer Fulwell as the administrator, does not know how much is being paid individually. We know it on aggregate, but individually for those procedures. And that's because it's a quote unquote trade secret. And that's the transparency aspect or part of it that he wants to bring. And he wants to know exactly how much is being spent with Duke for, you know, a 65-year-old patient that has a hip replacement, with, you know, UNC, how much are we paying? The second part is just the simple wants to reduce costs by $300 million. That's sort of a little bit easier to sort of wrap your head around. Just wants to pay less, you know, reduce the cost of healthcare. And to do this, sort of the blunt force object that he's using to do this is to say, if you're not going to tell me how much it's going to cost, I'm going to reimburse you only an amount that's pegged to Medicare. So Medicare, of course, is a government payer in the way we traditionally think of it. Medicare basically hands down a decree and says, we're going to pay hospital X for this procedure, and you can take it or not, but that's what we're paying. And the treasurer is now saying, well, what I want to do is I'm going to pay a percentage above that rate. So if Duke gets whatever, you know, $100 for an aspirin from Medicare, the treasurer is going to pay 177% of that to Duke. And that brings a lot more, you know, assurity. You know exactly what it's going to cost you. And it's ultimately going to be a good bit less for the state health plan. Or not, I say a good bit, it'll be that $300 million mm-hmm. less for the state health plan.
The apparent proprietary nature of billing and what things cost in healthcare, I'm unaware of another industry, whether we think of, I don't know, automotive or audio engineering, whatever it may be, the secrecy around this stuff. I don't believe it exists. Real estate, it doesn't exist in any other industries in our that I'm aware of.
Financial advising, I would say, is pretty secretive as well.
In terms of like the fees and such.
Sure,
such.
Yeah.
Sure.
But I think that's sort of accentuates the point is that, you know, there's but the people that are in the industry like it that way, right?
Because there's a lack of transparency.
Exactly. And so you and I don't know what it is that we're actually paying. And you know, and that applies even on the premium side as well. So we know what we pay. In some cases, people don't even know what they pay in their premiums because it comes out before, you know, their take-home portion of their paycheck. But nonetheless, that's an easier dollar number to find as to how much you pay in premiums every month for your healthcare. But the amount that you don't know is how much your employer pays in those premiums. So just right out of the gate, on the very front end, there's sort of this question mark as to how much you're actually paying per year just to even have health coverage to begin with. Then if you do need to use your health care for whatever reason, emergency or otherwise, have a baby, say, there's this even bigger black box for how much am I paying? How much is my insurance company paying? Is my employer paying anything else? Could I have paid less? What, you know, could I have gotten a better deal somewhere else? It is a giant black box. People do not know. This is, in my opinion, by far the greatest issue with our healthcare system And you know, you can talk about the Affordable Care Act making changes, Medicaid expansion, all those are good things to talk about, but it's just this massive misunderstanding and you know, payment black box in the healthcare system that, in my opinion, has just caused these costs to skyrocket over the past really about 20, 25 years.
Sure, and it might be an oversimplification, but it does seem as though if reining in of healthcare spending is going to actually happen there on some level in different places, I'm not advocating for anybody here, but it seems as though transparency certainly could be a viable part of that equation. The party, I want to get back to the Falwell versus the Republican lawmakers here in a moment. Let me ask you this. This might be a throwaway, but there's also this huge parallel conversation on the healthcare front taking place right now in North Carolina as it pertains to Medicaid. Medicaid, by and large, is not part of this conversation because state health plan folks already have coverage. That's my read on it. Is that your read on it as well?
Yeah, not only by and far, but completely separate.
Of course,
yeah,
right,
I mean, it's completely separate. I mean, this is one thing to sort of consider is that we are not talking about government payers. So if you are, you know, on your own private health insurance, if you're a retiree, you know, not from, let's say you're not a teacher, this does not affect you. But it does affect every single person that's on the state health plan. And as you said at the top, this is not an insignificant number of people. I mean, we're talking 750,000 people that this is going to affect. And to sort of put that in perspective, when we talk about Medicaid expansion, we're talking about, you know, tens or a few hundreds of thousands of people that would, you know, be added to the rolls. Even the highest projections, I think, are like 500,000 people. So that's significant, obviously, but this is an even bigger program than what would be added to Medicaid if Medicaid were fully expanded the way initially conceived under Obamacare.
So quick math, always dangerous on the radio, but I think the biggest projections for Medicaid expansion would add between 600,000 and 650,000 people. But again, this, what we're talking about, a separate healthcare issue, would be applicable to 720,000 state employees. Loose math, that's just about 7% of the state's population. Now, the Republican Party, last I checked, has been offering some support of Treasurer Falwell's, we'll call it fiscal prudency, and his attempt at greater transparency. State lawmakers, Republican lawmakers, have been more divided. Some have shared skepticism, just with conversations I've had with some Republican lawmakers, I've heard skepticism of Falwell's ultimate goal here. Some have had some frustration. They describe a lack of pragmatism on his part and say that he's, you know, he's effectively drawn this hard line or this firm line in the sand. These negotiations, from my perspective, have not gone anywhere in recent weeks, probably months now. Do you have an expectation of where things go from here and when? Because there is a December 1st deadline, I believe, for a new state health plan contract, and we're coming up on just needing to get that going. So where are things, and when, if at all, do they move, by your estimation?
Yeah, that's a good question. So the part of the reason we're talking about this right now is because the treasurer had set a deadline of July 1st to have everyone signed on to this new plan. Is called the Clear Pricing Project. So he had hoped to have everybody that wants to be in. So, you know, hospitals, providers sign on, and then you're the ones that are then in network. The in network being the ones that accept this Medicare plus, you know, 177% of Medicare payment, flat rate, no negotiation. If you as a provider accept that, you have to notify the treasurer's office, or you were supposed to have notified the treasurer's office by July 1st. So that's part of the reason why we're talking about it now, is because that deadline just passed. Now, if you're on the state health plan and you're listening to this, don't worry. That was sort of an artificial deadline.
Right, it's not a real deadline.
Because as you mentioned, you know, the plan that you currently have is good through December 31st. So regardless of anything else, the plan that you currently have is the one that you're going to keep until December 31st. Clearly, something would need to change before that if you don't want to have all of your hospitals go out of network. But the question is more of, okay, well, when is that sort of like actual deadline? Open enrollment is in the fall. Should it probably happen before that? Likely. At what point does Blue Cross or the state health plan need to start printing out flyers or sort of have its plan designs ready? Probably sometime before that. So, you know, my estimation is that a more clear deadline is sort of in that September timeframe, late August, early September timeframe. But even that could potentially be pushed back. And really the actual deadline is December 31st. To the first part of it, so that's the when. To the first part of your question of what is going to happen, honestly, I don't know. Because at this point, it does not seem that the treasurer has any intention of budging from his position. And from all of the hospitals that I've talked to, which are the big ones, UNC, Duke, Cone, you know, the one Atrium in Charlotte, they don't seem like they want to budge either. And so what's going to happen? That's really a great question. There's also a bill floating out there that would put a pause to all of this. It's House Bill 184. The House passed it. I forget exactly when, a month or two ago. The House passed it, and basically what it does is it just puts a stop to all of this. It sides with the hospitals in the sense that it does not allow the treasurer to go forward with his Medicare Plus take it or leave it proposal, but it also doesn't completely knock that out of the water because it says it's going to create a study commission that would then look at hospital costs and look at healthcare costs and if there's a way to try to find some middle ground. I think at this point, the providers and hospitals are putting their eggs in that basket, hoping that they can apply enough pressure to enough members of the North Carolina Senate to pull up that House bill and pass that so that everything that happens after that sort of, you know, from the treasurer's perspective is put on pause and you know, taken up again next year or the year after that. So. Right. I think that's what we're looking at probably most closely in terms of the most, you know, will we have an answer immediately would be looking what happens with House Bill 184.
House Bill 184, tin boot, meat metal can. One historical note on this, and that is that the legislature used to effectively run the state health plan. From the conversations that I have had, they have zero interest in doing that again. Guest here on the WUNC Politics Podcast is Jason DeBruin. He covers a lot of things for us, for WUNC. He's our data reporter. You can follow him on Twitter at Jason DeBruin, spelling lesson, DeBruyn. Let's chat redistricting for a moment before the lightning round. We had this big ruling that came down from the Roberts Court last Thursday that effectively said there is no justiciability in the federal courts. The high court, the appellate courts, and no federal bench can weigh in as it comes to extreme partisan gerrymandering. The case that was before the U.S. Supreme Court, there was a challenge based on democratically drawn congressional maps in Maryland and congressional maps that came out of North Carolina that were established by the Republican state legislature. So that effectively put to rest the issue of partisan gerrymandering in the federal courts. That was last week. But of course, this being a very dynamic time in North Carolina politics, there is a trial that is set to begin a week from Monday. This is a state challenge to legislative maps. Those are the 170 state House and state Senate maps at the North Carolina General Assembly. Common Cause has sued, and not over racial gerrymandering, but over partisan gerrymandering, has what we foresee or forecast as a more favorable bench at the state level. There are now six Democrats and one Republican on the state Supreme Court. So there is a trial that's going to begin not before the state Supreme Court, we should note, but before a three-judge panel a week from Monday. I believe it's a week from Monday. Everything's flowing together now. I believe it's the 15th, in which there's going to be another challenge to partisan maps. So much to talk about here, but we're just going to touch on it a little bit. What are you looking for? What are you going to be most closely following as this trial gets going and progresses?
That's a good question.
And take it in a different direction if you want. I mean,
sure.
Yeah.
Sure. So, you know, I guess just to see ultimately what's going to happen when it goes to the state Supreme Court. I mean, obviously, the arguments are going to be pretty similar, I think, right, to the ones that were made before the federal Supreme Court. You know, they're pretty similar. You know, the egregious nature of how badly they're gerrymandered is pretty similar, though not as bad with these new maps that were used for the North Carolina state legislature in 2018. The thing to watch is that now that the Supreme Court, the federal Supreme Court has said we don't have purview over this, is the North Carolina State Supreme Court going to say, well, we're happy to look at our state, and as you mentioned, with a pretty, you know, with liberals having a pretty heavy, you know, numerical advantage on the state Supreme Court,
right.
Are they going to turn, are they going to then side with Democrats and say that, in fact, they were too, you know, very badly gerrymandered, and that, in fact, it's against the state constitution to have such an extreme partisan gerrymander, mm-hmm. and then overturn those maps, and what does that do for Democrats then in 2020? I guess that's ultimately what we're going to be curious about, right? Is what are the maps going to look like in 2020, and then how is that going to affect the outcome?
And I think it's important to mention that when the opinion came down last week, we had, you know, this very strong dissent from Justice Elena Kagan.
Kagan, yeah.
But Roberts also said, you know, there is a pathway to fixing partisan gerrymandering, and it exists in Congress and in state houses across the nation. He didn't indicate that this was an issue for state Supreme Courts, and not that he would or wouldn't do that. But I do think that for the defendants in this case and for some of the people that think, hey, the state Supreme Court here does not need to weigh in on this issue. This is for ultimately the state House and state Senate. And I realize there's a little irony in asking these people to fix what they've done to some extent. But I do think we're going to hear that refrain over the next month. I think we're going to hear people say, hey, the highest court in the land said this isn't an issue for the judiciary. And they're going to try to apply some pressure on the state court as well to not, you know, issue a fundamentally transformative ruling. So that's one thing I'm listening for. But go ahead.
Well, but of course they are, right? I mean, like the ones that want to see the map stay the same in North Carolina are going to interpret the justice's majority ruling as saying that the court should stay out of it completely. And they're going to say that because they're afraid that a more liberal state Supreme Court would overturn them. Of course, if you're in the minority in North Carolina and you want to see the maps overturned, then you're going to look at what Justice Roberts said and say, oh, well, he said that only the federal Supreme Court didn't have purview over this, but left it to the states. Look at what Pennsylvania Supreme Court did. We could do the same thing here in North Carolina, which, of course, you mentioned the word irony. I mean, this is dripping in irony because politicians create a problem that then the Supreme Court says politicians need to fix. Well, that circular argument is just exactly that. It's circular. And I'm not trying to pick on Republicans or Democrats, because if Democrats were in power, it serves to reason that it would be just as big of a problem there. If Democrats draw gerrymandered maps and then they say that they're fine and the Supreme Court says, well, the democratically controlled legislature needs to fix these democratically gerrymandered maps. I mean, it's really difficult to know what to do. And that's not to say that I think that the federal Supreme Court should have taken it up, because I think they actually make some pretty good points about this is a political problem. But who is the check? Who is the balance on this problem? And I don't know that it is a Supreme Court, either at the state or federal level, but it's certainly not also the people that created the problem in the first place. But then that opens up, okay, well, who is it? And I mean, I wish I had a better answer, but I don't.
Of course, right. And also at the heart of it is, what is too partisan? So whoever or whomever is the check, what is it that they're using? What are the parameters for being too partisan?
Yeah, and that's exactly the problem. And I think you can look at you hit the nail on the head. I mean, I think you can look at North Carolina and see that it is so badly gerrymandered that you could, I think, pretty reasonably say that it shouldn't be this out of whack. But that opens up the question, okay, well, what is too much, right? I mean, because no matter what, you're not going to have an exactly perfect split between this many people voted for Republicans, this many people voted for Democrats. That means you have that exact proportion across the state or nation of representation. It's just not going to happen. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. But at what point does it become too egregious? And that is a difficult question to answer. And frankly, that's one that I thought that the majority opinion was going to hit a little bit harder a week ago. And I was surprised to not see, you know, sort of that as much in the argument. But that's one that I am sensitive to. Like, at what point is it too bad? And that's a very difficult question to answer.
Was reminded recently of the Larry Flint case. It's a pornography case that rose to the U.S. Supreme Court, I think back in
I think it was back in the 90s, Justice Potter Stewart had, of course, that famous declaration, "I know it when I see it." Somebody mentioned that "I know it when I see it" to me recently. That somebody was Jason DeBruin. He's here on the WNC Politics podcast. I, full disclosure, I have to go run and do a newscast here in a little while as we're taping this on a Wednesday afternoon. So we need to move through some random various and sundry things before I go do that. So we've got just a couple of minutes left to do this. But want to move to a more somber note briefly. Charlie Slagle died this past Tuesday. Longtime Davidson men's soccer coach, was an institution in North Carolina, really in southeastern football circles. You are a former Division I soccer player, go Liberty Flames. Share with us your best Charlie Slagle story.
Oh, that's a good question. You know, he did a lot of goalkeeper work, I remember, and I wasn't a goalkeeper, but I played for Charlotte Soccer Club when I was a good bit younger, and then also worked as a coach at Charlotte Soccer Club. And I can always remember, even though that he was such a, at that point, you know, a pretty high-ranking member in the club and you know, in soccer circles everywhere, that he would still, you know, go out there and work with the goalkeepers, even, you know, the younger guys, the kids that are 14, 15, 16, and work with them and try to make them better. You know, I think he, to the end, of course, just absolutely loved the game. And I mean, you said the word institution. They're absolutely an institution for soccer, not only in this state, but across the Southeast. And it's too bad we lost him, but certainly some fond memories.
He was 67 years old. Your wife, talented, impressive woman already. Then she gave birth to twins this past spring. You already had a one-year-old. That is 1 + 2. Means you now have 3 children. All under, or I guess your daughter just turned 2, or is
just
about to turn 2.
Yeah. Just turned 2. Yeah.
One significant change in going from 1 to 3 children.
Just one.
Yeah, it's all we have time for. We can do podcast coming up.
Sure, sure. No, just that you don't have enough hands, right? I mean, like there's always going to be one kid that if they're not happy on autopilot, that you're just going to have to deal with them later. So if you're putting out fires and you have 3 fires to put out, well, you better choose 2 and you know, figure out that third one at some later time. I think that's the biggest change.
Best side dish to consume on the 4th of July?
That's a good question. Can I have a hamburger with a side of a bratwurst? Would that count?
Yep, you can do that. I'll allow it. What's on the brat?
Oh, I mean, everything. Peppers, onions, mayonnaise, mustard, ketchup, the works.
Sauerkraut?
Sure, yeah, sauerkraut, absolutely. I mean, literally everything that you can imagine would go on a brat, I'm putting it on there.
Jason DeBruin, WNC data reporter. You can follow him on Twitter, at Jason DeBruin. We needed more time. We'll do it again soon. Jason,
absolutely.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Make sure you subscribe to the podcast, tell a friend about it, leave us a review. You know the deal by now. We're on Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play. Thanks as always for tuning in, and stay up to date with whatever is happening in that dynamic North Carolina political sphere at our website, wunc.org. For Jason DeBruin, I'm Jeff Tiberi. Enjoy the long weekend.